Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll play some key moments from and invite your reactions to the Democratic debate last night to start the show in just a minute. We'll do impeachment developments later. We'll hear from the Trump Inc. team today with a big scoop of original reporting. They have found discrepancies in Donald Trump's tax returns, or I should say between Donald Trump's tax returns and other of his financial documents. Really interesting. Andrea Bernstein on that later. And we have Michael Moore at 11:30 this morning on the special screening that's going to take place this weekend of his classic documentary, Bowling for Columbine. We also get debate thoughts from Michael Moore, especially, and remember, he was, especially because he was one of the few oracles in 2016 who was out there saying Donald Trump could win. But the biggest Democratic presidential race news, I think, may have come not from the debate last night, but from the reports that broke during the debate that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will endorse Bernie Sanders. Ilhan Omar also just endorsed him, and reporting this morning says Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib will as well. So that's three of the four members of the so-called squad, right? Those four freshman women members of Congress. No word yet that I've seen on the fourth member of the squad, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, but AOC for Bernie. Let's start there with our first guest, Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer, also co-host of the New York City Politics podcast, FAQ NYC. Hi, Christina. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
The caricature of AOC would be that she would endorse a woman or a person of color based on demographic solidarity. The reality of AOC is that, if these reports are accurate, she's endorsing an old white male. Why do you think?
Because Bernie Sanders has been with AOC for quite some time. I mean, he was the one who actually was one of her initial supporters, especially using his stature and cachet when, you know, many people discarded her as just some, you know, some waitress trying to, you know, get attention. And she has shown that she's a grassroots activist along the same vein as Bernie Sanders. So of the 12 candidates who were on stage last night, he actually makes the most sense for her to support. I mean, there's descriptive and there's substantive representation. Obviously, descriptive is what you described. She would possibly support a woman of color, someone who's younger, maybe a millennial. Mm-hmm. But substantively, their policy positions are a lot more in line. And so this is now we're seeing she'll probably give Bernie a nice little bump. But keep in mind, they share bases, so it's not likely that people who support AOC haven't already thought about or supported Bernie.
She could have endorsed Elizabeth Warren.
They're not the same. I mean, I think, you know, Bernie Sanders has a certain type of supporter, especially from 2016, that I think is more in line with the AOC type of politics. And Elizabeth Warren's supporters, I think, are slightly ever so slightly to the right of possible Bernie, especially when it comes to the mechanics of how she'll implement some of her plans.
And we'll get into what I thought was a very interesting set of contrasts between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren last night. But in your opinion, as a political scientist, do these endorsements by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other members of the squad move votes in next year's primaries?
I don't think they're going to necessarily move votes. I think for AOC, the types of people, as I said before, who support her would support Bernie. For Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, maybe some of their constituents are using this endorsement as a guide. That might be very helpful, but it's still very early. And so once we see how things shake out, especially in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, I think that those endorsements will help people either choose Bernie or see who's available as a second choice option.
And listeners, we'll play a few debate excerpts now, but we also will take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC. Any reactions you had to anything in last night's debate? And if AOC is endorsing Bernie Sanders, does that matter to your own decision-making process one way or another? Or anything else you want to say or ask Christina Greer, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I thought one of the most important storylines from the debate last night, even before the AOC news, was that it was a good night for Bernie Sanders. People were certainly wondering how he would present after his heart attack, but I thought he looked like himself. And there was also that whole line pursued by the moderators about how he was direct and Elizabeth Warren was not about taxes going up to pay for Medicare for all, even though they both say the total costs for middle-class people will go down when you take away the premiums and the deductibles and everything. So I want to play a key stretch from that part of the debate. Do you want to say anything before we play it about what you were thinking?
Well, I think, you know, people who are Bernie supporters were probably very happy last night in the sense that he looked good and he was pretty direct and his tone sort of made sense. It wasn't angry. It wasn't restless. It wasn't annoyed. So I think if you're a Bernie supporter out there this morning, you're feeling good. And I think Warren supporters would probably feel good as well. I mean, it's hard being number one. And I mean, she's clearly surging in the polls. And so, you know, as we've talked about, that's when you get the bullseye on your back from everyone. And we saw that, you know, quite a few candidates went after her directly and explicitly last night.
We saw the previous debate where everybody went after Biden. Mm-hmm. This one, everybody was going after Elizabeth Warren because of her place at this moment in the polls. So this is a 2-minute clip. We'll hear Warren and Buttigieg and Klobuchar, all of them in this, but it starts with a senator from Vermont.
Well, as somebody who wrote the damn bill, as I said, let's be clear. Under the Medicare for All bill that I wrote, premiums are gone. Copayments are gone. Deductibles are gone. All out-of-pocket expenses are gone. We're going to do better than the Canadians do, and that is what they have managed to do. At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people will save money on their health care bills. But I do think it is appropriate to acknowledge that taxes will go up. They're going to go up significantly for the wealthy. And for virtually everybody, the tax increase they pay will be substantially less than what they were paying for premiums and out-of-pocket expenses.
Well, Senator Warren, will you acknowledge what the senator just said about taxes going up?
So my view on this and what I have committed to is costs will go down for hardworking middle-class families. I will not embrace a plan like Medicare for All who can afford it that will leave behind millions of people who cannot. And I will not embrace a plan that says people have great insurance right up until you get the diagnosis and the insurance company says, sorry, we're not covering your expensive cancer treatments. We're not covering your expensive treatments
for MS. Thank you, Senator.
We're Senator not covering
Klobuchar.
What you need.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up. And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that. And I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice. I believe the best and boldest idea here is to not trash Obamacare, but to do exactly what Barack Obama wanted to do from the beginning, and that's have a public option that would bring down the cost of the premium and expand the number of people covered and take on the pharmaceutical companies. That is what we should be doing instead of kicking 149 million people off their insurance in 4 years.
Amy Klobuchar, the last voice there. Christina Greer, what'd you make of that exchange? And maybe start with the contrast there between Warren and Sanders, the language they chose on the same plan, and people scratching their heads, why doesn't she just say flat out what Bernie Sanders says, which is, yes, we're going to have a tax hike to pay for Medicare for All, but for everybody but the richest Americans, it's going to be less total cost when you take away the premiums, deductibles, copays.
Right. I don't know what her logic is because, you know, she's been so direct in so many other policies with being explicit about having a plan. Mm. And this is a question that she keeps getting. So either one, she fundamentally doesn't believe that it'll be a tax hike, or two, she doesn't want to say it so that it becomes a soundbite that, you know, gets wrapped around her constantly by her detractors.
And what did you make in general of people going after Warren for the first time and how she handled it?
Well, I think, you know, when when everyone's coming at you for the first time, it does take a second for you to get your footing. I mean, we've seen it with Biden. Biden has stumbled consistently in almost every debate, yet and still his numbers are holding steady. And there's some gender demographics there and some other demographics that can explain why. And so with Warren, I think, you know, she held herself quite well having so many people essentially come directly at her. But this is the point of a debate. I mean, you know, we want to see a candidate get better. You know, when we if we think back to 2008 with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama going back and forth and back and forth, both of them became much better candidates by having to answer for some of their policies and past practices, or in Obama's case, lack thereof, because he did not necessarily have that experience. And so I think this is a good thing for her, and since she's already secured in for the next debate in November, I think that she'll be a lot more prepared for some of these questions, because obviously Medicare and the cost of health care will come up consistently, even though some of the candidates are frustrated by the fact that it seems like we're having this conversation constantly for a good 20 to 30 minutes out of a debate sometimes, and it doesn't seem as though Democratic voters are getting a full answer.
Here's one more Sanders moment that I want to play, and again, it's a direct answer. This was not a headline moment from the debate that I think the whole national media is talking about, but I thought it was an interesting contrast on an interesting issue between Sanders and Andrew Yang, and it's again Sanders being very direct, owning a program that might sound radical to some people, and we will hear pushback to his answer from Andrew Yang. The question comes from CNN moderator Aaron Burnett.
Senator Sanders, you say your federal jobs guarantee is part of the answer to the threat from automation, but tens of millions of Americans could end up losing their jobs. Are you promising that you will have a job for every single one of those Americans?
Damn right we will. And I'll tell you why. If you look at what goes on in America today, we have an infrastructure which is collapsing. We could put 15 million people to work rebuilding our roads, our bridges, our water systems, our wastewater plants, airports, etc. Furthermore, and I hope we will discuss it at length tonight, this planet faces the greatest threat in its history from climate change. And the Green New Deal that I have advocated will create up to 20 million jobs as we move away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
The fact is, most Americans do not want to work for the federal government. And saying that that is the vision of the economy of the 21st century, to me, is not a vision that most Americans would embrace. Also, Senator Sanders, a description of a federal jobs guarantee does not take into account the work of people like my wife, who's at home with our two boys, one of whom is autistic. We have a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month. It actually recognizes the work that is happening in our families and our communities. It helps all Americans transition.
So candidate Andrew Yang there, and part of the answer that he gave after Senator Sanders' answer on a federal jobs guarantee. And Christina Greer, this is a debate among the economic left, to be sure, a federal jobs guarantee versus handing every American a check for $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, last night, I thought. Does it matter politically?
I think so, because there's a fundamental nuance, and this is where I think Yang actually really landed some punches, because, you know, the clip goes on to say, beyond the $1,000, he has said that many of these retraining programs have failed, and they are training people for jobs no one wants. Now, I don't know exactly know who no one is, but he went on then to say that his plan would have a trickle-up effect, which is in contrast to Bernie Sanders' plan, which is essentially keep things as a status quo or sort of keep people afloat, which I think is the difference. And then he went into a little bit more detail with saying, I know you all are sort of getting scared by seeing all these kiosks. And, you know, truck drivers need these jobs because as my friends in the Silicon Valley are moving towards driverless trucks, you know, trucks and truck drivers and motels and restaurants are sort of the lifeblood of the economy. So he sort of expanded his vision just a little bit, which I think probably resonated not just with some of the Ohio folks in the audience, but quite honestly, people across the 50 states. We have to remember that, you know, we keep talking about this amorphous, you know, mysterious Midwestern real American, but I think Yang was actually talking to a lot of folks who were a little afraid about their job prospects, whether they live in cities, suburbs, or rural communities.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Fordham politics professor Christina Greer, also host of the New York City politics podcast, FAQ NYC, as we talk about the national politics of the Democrats' debate last night. And we can take your reactions to the debate and questions, as we are going to go through a number more clips and a couple of other topics, some that are really breaking out as headlines and some that aren't, but I think should, from last night. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take a call right now from Mary in Brooklyn. Hi, Mary, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I'm calling because last night, listening to Elizabeth Warren, whom I have supported for a long, long time now, listening to her directly evade or repeatedly evade the question of raising taxes to pay for Medicare for All over and over to give a non-answer and evade to repeated requests from questioners or from the perhaps the one questioner who was pursuing this. I really felt she was insulting the intelligence of voters, whom she seems to assume don't notice those evasions. It seemed very, very unlike what she originally presented herself like, as, you know, as a person who was able to give honest answers, even when they're difficult. And I saw in my mind, you know, she's courting Bernie's voters and won't say the words. But to do that so blatantly, those evasions, mm-hmm. really bothered me. And I found myself admiring Amy Klobuchar's honesty.
Mm-hmm. Mary, let me ask you a question. Are you a Medicare for All supporter? And if Elizabeth Warren, especially if Sanders runs his course, his campaign runs its course, and he needs to drop out after a while because he doesn't have enough support, and Warren emerges as the nominee. I heard an analysis from Obama's former campaign director on TV last night, who David Axelrod, who said that he thinks this is what will happen. If Bernie Sanders eventually drops out and Elizabeth Warren seems headed toward the nomination, that she will open the door a crack for people to keep their private insurance. If she does that, would you like that? Would it bother you, or does it make any difference?
Well, I have thought about that, too. If she's honest, and being honest, she opens the door any crack, that's fine with me. I just don't like her refusing to say words that I feel more and more is a convenience for her. Maybe not a convenience, but a strategy. Mm-hmm. And I'm a person who supports Medicare for All, but I need about 10% persuasion still.
Mm-hmm. Mary, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. I guess Warren is just trying to, and you said it, Christina, not give the Republicans a talking point that Elizabeth Warren is going to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. So she only wants to state the bottom line of the formula, which is that everybody except the very rich will pay less for health care in the long run when you do the addition and you do the subtraction.
Right. I mean, you don't want a 1992 George H.W. Bush yourself, you know, where it's read my lips, no new taxes.
And then he raised taxes.
There he was, and he was a one-term president.
That was much worse. He wouldn't raise taxes.
Yeah. But we know that in this social media age, I mean, there would be a clip of a clip that would essentially muddy the waters. But I think Mary's really important point for a lot of voters or potential voters last night is this idea of honesty. And they're looking for a candidate because we have someone in D.C. who is so dishonest, who has surrounded himself clearly with so many men who are dishonest and doing dishonest things in the name of our nation, domestically and abroad. Elizabeth Warren has done such, I think, a stellar job of being a politician, but presenting herself as, I am, you know, from the same cloth as you all. I was a single mom. I worked my way up. I may have had this fancy job in an Ivy League institution, but, you know, I used to travel in my beat up car with my kids in the back. You know, this image that made her completely relatable. And I'm not saying that that image is gone, but if there are quite a few voters who feel the way Mary just articulated, then Warren is going to have to really do something different in the next debate to assuage some of those fears.
Corey in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Corey. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to call in and say, of the watching the debate last night as a moderate Republican, I voted for Gary Johnson in the last election because I wanted to, you know, express my true opinion on my vote.
Libertarian independent candidate, for people who don't know the name.
And I do like what Bill Weld's doing running against Trump right now, even though it's not getting any attention whatsoever. But I really liked Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar last night. I really hope that Democrats will look to bring in moderates and Republicans who are disgusted with what's going on right now in the nation. And Medicare for All is not something that I'm very enthused about, and I think Amy Klobuchar's, you know, bringing in people who are of the same persuasion as me, and I really like what Pete Buttigieg said about Syria. I was really disappointed to hear what Tulsi Gabbard's opinion was, and I feel like Pete Buttigieg really, you know, said what needed to be said about America needs to take a strong place in this world and represent the values that we have here.
Corey, I'm curious. It sounds like as a young moderate Republican, as you describe yourself, you're not a fan of Donald Trump. But if in 2020 it's Trump versus one of these Democrats, are you saying you think you might bring yourself to vote for Buttigieg or Klobuchar, but not the others?
I would probably vote third party over Elizabeth Warren at this point, but I won't vote for Trump.
Corey, thanks for your call. Keep calling us. We really appreciate it. So Corey set up the next stretch of things that I want to do with clips. And so when we come back from this break, I'm going to play how I thought Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker really distinguished themselves on the impeachment line of questioning. And we'll also get into that Tulsi Gabbard from the peace camp and all that flowed from that. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we play clips from and get your reactions to last night's Democratic debate with Christina Greer, Fordham University political science professor and co-host of the New York City Politics podcast, FAQ NYC. Another big narrative I thought last night was Pete Buttigieg really trying to make a move and step out as a contrast to Senator Warren and I guess an alternative to Joe Biden if Biden should falter. The previous caller from just before the break, the moderate Republican who was interested in Buttigieg, started inching toward the kind of clip that we're going to hear here. And this was from the very first moments of the debate. And I think it's the essence of Buttigieg's message right now. Say Buttigieg's 10 times fast. It came in his first answer of the night in the opening minutes of the debate, when he was asked his position on impeachment, and he turned it around to focus it on the presidency after Donald Trump.
But everyone on this stage, by definition, is competing to be a president for after the Trump presidency. Remember, one way or the other, this presidency is going to come to an end. I want you to picture what it's going to be like, what it's actually going to feel like in this country the first day the sun comes up after Donald Trump has been president. It starts out feeling like a happy thought. This particular brand of chaos and corruption will be over. But really think about where we'll be. Vulnerable. Even more torn apart by politics than we are right now. And these big issues, from the economy to climate change, have not taken a vacation during the impeachment process. I'm running to be the president who can turn the page and unify a dangerously polarized country while tackling those issues are going to be just as urgent then as they are now.
So, Christina, what I was wondering as I was listening to that was, was that going over people's heads? Because people aren't looking that far down the road. He's running to be a unifier post-Trump. And he was basically accusing Warren and Sanders of not being that with Medicare for All, and Beto O'Rourke of not being that with his mandatory assault weapon buyback. But I didn't know if that message might have just kind of gone a little over the heads of a lot of people. But that's clearly how Buttigieg is trying to position himself as the one who can bring the country back together after, whew, this Trump misery is over.
Right. And here's the complicated conversation, because Buttigieg does that so beautifully in sort of this lofty language.
Yes.
But, you know, I'm sure his supporters always go crazy on Twitter. But it's like the details aren't there compared to some of his competitors. And so the language is necessary and it's helpful. And I think he is crafting a lane in case Biden falters. I think that he's connecting with voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. Whether you like him or not, there's something there that's frustrating for, say, the Warren-Bernie wing. But I think what Buttigieg represents is this fundamental difference within the Democratic Party right now, or the divide within the Democratic Party. People like Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden are saying, the ship is going in the wrong direction. After Trump, we need to right the ship. And I'm the person who can unify us and right that ship. People like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are saying the ship is corroded and rotten to the core, always has been. So not only do we need to rip apart this ship and build anew, once we build a whole new ship, then we need to set its sail in a different direction. There's so many Democrats who believe in sort of the Buttigieg line of thinking, which is we change who's in the Oval Office, we try and bring the country together, and then we can go back to having brunch and sort of talking about politics in a non sort
right.
of threatening way.
Not but enough change that was needed
exactly,
anyway.
Exactly.
Cory Booker was also interesting in the impeachment section, I thought. They were all for it, basically. Maybe Tulsi Gabbard not, or she did come to yes eventually.
Tulsi had word salads last night, per usual.
But Booker also seemed to reach out to the middle by focusing not on how criminal Trump is. They all believe he's criminal, but by making a promise.
Look, I share the same sense of urgency of everybody on this stage. I understand the outrage that we all feel, but we have to conduct this process in a way that is honorable, that brings our country together, doesn't rip us apart. Anybody who has criticisms about a process that is making all the facts bare before the American public, that works to build consensus, that's what this nation needs in what is a moral moment and not a political one. So I swore an oath to do my job as a senator, do my duty. This president has violated his, I will do mine.
So there's Cory Booker, Christina, out there last night promising Donald Trump due process in the impeachment inquiry. Not that, you know, Nancy Pelosi and the people who are in the House are not promising him due process, but he made a point of it. So my question for you is, where's Cory Booker looking for support right now with answers like that? I think he's admitted that he's financially hanging by a thread in this campaign.
Well, I mean, you know, I actually have in my notes this quote, moral movement and moral moment that we're in right now. I mean, if this were a play, it seems as though Cory Booker would essentially be the moral conscience of the 12 characters in the play. I don't necessarily know if he fundamentally believes that he's going to make it to the finish line as president. But then again, you know, as we've seen, things happen. So he's hanging in there and he's giving it his all. But I do think that there is a place in whoever does win. It seems as though there will be a place for Cory somewhere because he is essentially he's not filled with ire, and I think he is trying to excavate all of the good and goodness that is in this country, and that's actually something that a lot of Democratic voters want, maybe not necessarily in their first choice candidate, but it's not enough for them to vote for him for the presidency. But I think a lot of people like the passion that he has for the goodness of our nation.
And before we leave the impeachment thread, here's how Biden handled the Hunter Biden question from Anderson Cooper.
Mr. Vice President, as you said, your son Hunter today gave an interview, admitted that he made a mistake and showed poor judgment by serving on that board in Ukraine. D- did you make a mistake by letting him? You were the point person on Ukraine at the time. If you can answer.
Look, my son's statement speaks for itself. I did my job. I never discussed a single thing with my son about anything having to do with Ukraine. No one has indicated I have. We've always kept everything separate. Even when my son was the attorney general of the state of Delaware, we never discussed anything. So there'd be no potential conflict. My son made a judgment. I'm proud of the judgment he made. I'm proud of what he had to say. And let's focus on this. The fact of the matter is that this is about Trump's corruption. That's what we should be focusing on.
So nobody followed up after that. Mm-hmm. No moderator or candidate made a thing of it. Any surprise there?
No, I think a lot of Democrats recognize that this is, it's important, but it's still somewhat of a distraction. I think a lot of people like to keep spouses and children off the table. I was surprised that no one sort of quickly pivoted, or at least Biden didn't quickly pivot to the fact that Ivanka and Jared made $82 million last year. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, listen, if we're talking about this, then let's have a full conversation. I think he wanted to get over that conversation so we could get back to him and policy. And I think a lot of Democratic voters want to as well. And so it is an important discussion to have. But unfortunately, I think that there's a certain level of nepotism and financial nepotism that all voters are accustomed to. I think the difference is this widespread theft that's happening right now amongst the Trump family. But I do think that we've seen it time and time again with spouses and children sort of having positions on boards and sort of financially benefiting from, you know, their loved one who's in a position of power. There's a certain level of that that has always existed in this nation, literally since day one. What we're seeing now is a giant overreach in the Trump family. And so that's a thin needle that Biden has to thread.
And I think as far as the moderators, the debate sponsors were CNN and the New York Times, and they've both done so much to debunk the theory that Trump is working from on this, because there's absolutely no evidence that Joe Biden did anything
right.
in the
so
least
why,
corrupt.
Like,
so
why waste
how
time?
Could they press mm-hmm. it
exactly.
when they their own fact checkers have already debunked it?
Right.
John Michael in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, John Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
First of all, thank you for letting me vent. I really appreciate it. I think they should keep Cory Booker in for forever. He's fantastic. He really is the bridge to a lot of what's going on here. But, you know, my issue is I'm a huge Pete Buttigieg fan, but the problem is, and I've given to him, you know, multiple times in the past, but my problem with him and Klobuchar is the fact that, you know, they're attacking Elizabeth Warren. And, yes, she's not doing a good job of explaining, you know, why it's costs that are going to go down and that taxes are not going to go up for the middle class. But I really feel like that they don't fundamentally understand health care in this country and the problem that's going on here. I have health care with one of the biggest corporations on the planet Earth. And that's through my wife's company and through my company, which mm-hmm. is about a $120 million company. I have health care.
Uh-huh.
But they're awful. They're both terrible. That's the problem. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I'm just listening.
And
I think to your point, you know, when a lot of people say they're satisfied with their private health insurance, well, yeah, they're kind of glad they're covered, but they're getting nickel and dime to death on copays and deductibles and premiums. And if they really had it side by side under a Bernie Sanders plan or Elizabeth Warren plan, the way they're going to lay it out, maybe they would choose Medicare for All. I'm not sure people have the information yet to make those one-on-one comparisons.
Well, I mean, I think things need to be brought up, like the fact that I guess there was an article came out last week where there was a study and the waste, fraud, and abuse was mostly administrative costs that equaled about $760 billion or almost, you know, our military budget. And the conclusion of the article was there was no way to get rid of it. Well, the way to get rid of it is, and obviously the gold standard is a single-payer system, but the way to get there really is by continuing to lower the mm-hmm. age for a Medicare, creating a Medicare for All system, and then stop, you know, paying $500 a vial for insulin that costs $5
right.
to produce.
Exactly.
It's insane.
It's insane. So who are you for?
I love Warren. I've loved Warren since before she ran. I was giving to her on a monthly basis in the past, but you know, I've sort of stuck with Bernie and with Pete Buttigieg, and even AOC. But it's really all about Warren. I really mm-hmm. think that she's going to be the nominee. I'm kind of worried about Biden, even though he had a better night last night. But I just feel like he's a little out of touch with things. Mm-hmm. And even though he's got wonderful experience, when you look at Bernie's energy and his dynamism and his ability to explain things, and that he's almost the same age as Biden, it's really extraordinary, the contrast between the two.
And you weren't bothered last night by Warren's refusal to state directly that she would raise taxes like Bernie Sanders said it, but that the total cost, you know, to just state that part of it, that the taxes would go up, but the total cost of health care would go down?
I really feel like, and I hate to say this, that the media is like an unindicted co-conspirator, and they're going to be one of the other obstacles besides Trump and some hardcore conservatives that are going to try and stop this, and like Wall Street. Is, you know, I feel like the only answer the media wants is the fact that she has to say, yes, it's going to go up. But, you know, I checked out Cobra this week just to see what it'd be like, you know, as they're shuffling things at my wife's work. If they downsize, it's $1,800 a month
right.
just to for medical, another $400 for the dental. That's $2,200 a month, you know.
Totally. Well, Cobra is when you lose your job and you can, for a period of time under the law, buy into the health plan for yourself that your company was providing you, but whatever they were paying to the insurance company for you, you then have to pay it out of your pocket.
Yes, there might be a downsizing going on in my wife's work, and that's why, you know, we were inquiring about it to try and head that off
yes.
of the past. But, you know, it's going to be $1,800 to $2,200 gotcha. A month for a family of four.
John Michael, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. I want to play, let's cue up this Kamala Harris cut. Because we haven't heard yet from Kamala Harris, who has been sinking in recent polls, and I thought she stood out last night on the issue of reproductive rights.
I questioned Brett Kavanaugh when I was a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and asked him, as a nominee to serve on the United States Supreme Court, could he think of any law that tells a man what to do with his body? And the answer was no. The reality of it is, this is still a fundamental issue of justice for women in America. Women have been given the responsibility to perpetuate the human species. Our bodies were created to do that. And it does not give any other person the right to tell a woman what to do with that body. It is her body, it is her right, it is her decision.
And another moment in the debate, Christina, as I'm sure you saw at the beginning, near the beginning, when they were having that whole Medicare for All debate mm-hmm. back and forth and taxes and costs and private insurance, when it came Kamala Harris's time to get into that, she said, you know, nobody's talking about mm-hmm. choice.
Right.
So she brought it up that time, and then there was an explicit question on it, and that's what we played the clip from. So she distinguished herself, I thought, on that issue last night, but she's been sinking in the polls. What's happening to Kamala Harris?
Well, there are a few things. So, Emmy, and I thought her conversation about reproductive health care for poor women, for women of color, for access to all women, and making it a part of the health care and Medicare for All debate was really important. And obviously, Cory Booker followed up with saying, like, it shouldn't just be Kamala talking about this.
Right, men have to talk about this, too.
Men should be the allies as well.
I think I thought that he had planned the same
exactly.
interruption to bring it up when not asked. And so she stole his thunder. She upstaged him by doing it first, but he did it anyway and said, yeah, but men have to take this position strongly
and
too,
it,
which
it,
is right.
It works though, because, you know, as we've seen, you know, Biden doesn't necessarily connect with younger female voters, and he's definitely sinking with female voters just because many of his statements, as you've seen on the campaign trail, he starts with, you know, well, women, I'm sure you don't know this. You know, that's very insulting. And so if you follow sort of social media, you'll see lots of women each time with, you know, his exchange with Warren and the condescending ways that he talks to female candidates. So for Kamala, I think she's in somewhat of a double bind in the sense that she has done incredibly well in the Senate hearings. She did incredibly well with Brett Kavanaugh. She has shown that her prosecutorial chops are bar none. She is ostensibly trying to make the case that she is the best candidate to be the president of the United States. In doing so, she's also exposing the fact that she was a prosecutor. And so for younger voters, for a lot of voters of color, her time as the Attorney General of the state of California and some of the policies that she enacted when she was in charge as a prosecutor makes some people feel very uncomfortable. And this pivot to the left for some seems not as genuine as she may frame it. And so as you present yourself as a prosecutor to make the case that you were the best person to go up against Donald Trump and become the next president of the United States, you're also showing that you were a really great prosecutor, and it leaves people to remember or imagine some of the things that they have heard that you have done.
I want to play one more thread here, and this is a 2-minute clip. One more stretch, because I thought it was one of the biggest contrasts of the night and a divide among Democrats that's getting very little media attention in general on the issue of war, that the media is playing down because Trump has bungled his Syria withdrawal so badly with such deadly consequences so far. I think that's irrefutable, and he deserves as much blame as he's getting. But Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard chastised Democrats last night who supported, you know, another military intervention in the Middle East in the first place, and she challenged Elizabeth Warren to respond. Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, first of all, we've got to understand the reality of the situation there, which is that the slaughter of the Kurds being done by Turkey is yet another negative consequence of the regime change war that we've been waging in Syria. Donald Trump has the blood of the Kurds on his hand, but so do many of the politicians in our country from both parties who have supported this ongoing regime change war in Syria that started in 2011, along with many in the mainstream media who have been championing and cheerleading this regime change war. Not only that, but New York Times and CNN have also smeared veterans like myself for calling for an end to this regime change war. Just 2 days ago, the New York Times put out an article saying that I'm a Russian asset and an Assad apologist and all these different smears. This morning, a CNN commentator said on national television that I'm an asset of Russia. Completely despicable. As president, I will end these regime change wars by doing two things: ending the draconian sanctions that are really a modern-day siege, the likes of which we are seeing Saudi Arabia wage against Yemen, that have caused tens and thousands of Syrian civilians to die and to starve. And I would make sure that we stop supporting terrorists like al-Qaeda in Syria, who've been the ground force in this ongoing regime change war. I'd like to ask Senator Warren if she would join me in calling for an end to this regime change war in Syria, finally.
So, look, I think that we ought to get out of the Middle East. I don't think we should have troops in the Middle East, but we have to do it the right way, the smart way. What this president has done is that he has sucked up to dictators. He has made impulsive decisions that often his own team doesn't understand. He has cut and run on our allies, and he has enriched himself at the expense of the United States of America.
So, Christina Greer, we're going to run out of time in a minute, but I'm curious what you made of that exchange. One could say, on one level, Tulsi Gabbard was just a big mess last night.
Per usual.
But, you know, by the same token, she's reminding people that Democrats have traditionally been against these interventions in the first place, and now they're being very quiet while Trump is getting criticized by the Lindsey Graham, you know, always for war wing when Trump is trying to get out.
Right, but I think, you know, the exchange between Buttigieg and Gabbard after this was really important because he actually made some fundamental sort of specifics about what's going on. And he's actually like, no, it's not a regime change war. And so your buzzwords are actually off as the two vets on stage. And so for me, Gabbard...
Which is true. We didn't go in to overthrow Assad. Assad, we went in because ISIS was growing in the chaos.
Right, right. And so, Gabbard, if your main sort of claim to fame is that you're a veteran and you understand foreign policy and then you bungle foreign policy, I also thought it was really interesting that she loves asking other candidates questions, but can very rarely answer questions herself. And so I'm actually curious to see who makes it to the November debates, because 12 candidates were not necessary. Mm-hmm. But this is still a democracy. We're holding on. But I really hope that we can get into even more substance to sort of really actually think about what the path looks like leading up to 2020, but also if the Democrats come to power.
Christina Greer, political science professor at Fordham University and co-host of the New York City Politics podcast, FAQ NYC. Christina, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.